TTF, police bureau personnel would be shielded from the chain of command. And I take it that that's based on the notion that the mayor would not, as the police commissioner, be exercising some kind of supervisory authority. Is that correct?
Well, I think in the first instance, Commissioner Fish, you have to rely on the wisdom of who this chief or the next chief or the chief after that assigns to the JTTF. Because if those officers don't report everything to their supervisors, the sergeant, the lieutenant, then that chain of command is broken. And in addition to that, because of the way the MOU is written, we believe that the city would essentially be saying one interpretation of the MOU, despite what you're being told today. And remember that the personalities can change. Next week, tomorrow, we've had several different special agents in charge of the FBI field office here since 9/11. We've had several different U.S. attorneys. Who knows who's going to be elected president in 2016? The MOU provides that its term is indefinite. So I think you need to ask yourselves, how can you assure that you are going to have the information you feel you need to know that anything untoward is happening? It's all classified under the terms of FBI rules. It can be withheld. And I think it's unlikely that the city would ever exercise its option to get out unless you have a mayor who looks at all of this material and concludes the way that Mayor Potter did, that this is just flat inconsistent with the chain of command and the proper way to operate a law enforcement agency in Oregon.
Thank you. Let me ask a related question. What, in your view, is the difference between the mayor exercising oversight under a non-disclosure or confidentiality agreement and the mayor exercising oversight with secret clearance?
In both instances, there probably isn't a huge difference. If you take as a given that what the special agent in charge and other personnel are going to tell the mayor will be the same thing. That's both the good and the bad.
I forget that all of the other law enforcement agencies that were listed on an earlier slide, but I seem to recall Multnomah County, Sheriff, State Police, Port of Portland. There were some other law enforcement agencies that are...
Well, those are the ones that are on the sort of the working group below the level of the JTTF itself. It's the Washington County Sheriff's Office,
Washington
the
County
Port
Sheriff,
and the Oregon State Police that are actually full members.
So thank you, Mayor. So let's take the Oregon State Police and the Washington County Sheriff's Office. Now, there's no dispute in this room that they are fully covered by Oregon law. They are obliged to follow, including 181.575. Do we have any evidence, since they've been a participant, that this statute has been violated?
Commissioner Fish and Mr. Mayor, members of the council, we don't have any evidence at all of anything that the JTTF has been doing.
Right. No, I understand that, but so there are lawsuits going on around the country. The last time we took this up, and the ACLU supported the as needed, and was prepared to support putting police officers into this arrangement on an as-needed basis. One of the important things we talked about was litigation around the country, evidence of wrongdoing. We assessed it, and we did a balancing test. And that's how you ended up, I understand, concluding that as needed, reduce the risk of some long-term violation of law, among other things. I'm just asking, do we have any specific evidence in through complaints or court cases or anything that their participation has led to a violation of the statute?
I think the major point I would make, Commissioner Fish, is that we have no way of knowing one way or the other whether there have been violations by the FBI or cooperating agencies like the state police. I would hope not, but the point is we have no way of knowing because those agencies are subject to the FBI's rules, and the FBI's rules keep everything secret, and their rules trump everything else.
Thank you. I think maybe I can add one example of case, and I don't want to detail this issue because of confidentiality. I think there was a case that my agency is involved. I don't know whether it's being seen as a violation of the agreement or law, but it was a case in Washington County where I got a call from a client, and after I investigated and visited the client, I learned that actually FBI agencies went to the schools of some of the family members, kids who were attending some of the schools in that area, and the kids were interviewed, and they very much was pulled up from the classroom and then been interviewed and when I looked at the cards that folks left for the family, definitely the state police was one of the folks who were involved in that case. So that's as much as I can share, but, you know.
Well, David, I'm sorry, one last point, going back to some testimony in an earlier panel. I just was curious to get your view. We had someone earlier argue that if Portland police officers subject to a chain of command at the city were participating in the JTTF, in fact, they could serve as effectively as watchdogs in that role. Please, let someone else raise the point, and let's show respect to people's points of view. And the argument that we heard from an early panelist was that, in fact, we'd have more influence by having participation and bringing Oregon values into the equation than if we didn't. And I wanted to get your reaction to that.
Again, Commissioner Fish, I don't want to minimize the positive actions that the Portland Police Bureau has taken in the past. You know, when Attorney General Ashcroft put out the call for dragnet interviews shortly after 9/11 of individuals who were in this country on visas based on the country of origin and their faith or their presumed faith, who were to be questioned about their political and religious views. The Portland Police Bureau refused to participate in that, although they were requested, and the city was part of the JTTF. So that's an instance where the city did step up. And I'm not telling you that would never happen or that the police bureau couldn't have some impact, positive impact behind the scenes. The problem is community is unlikely to ever find out about it, absent that kind of a dramatic situation. And I believe that our community would be safer if the police bureau distances itself, if it's still available to work with the FBI on a case-by-case basis, as the bureau would be under proposed Resolution 146. So it can actually have positive relationships based on trust with members of communities of color and minority religious faiths in this community that are not tainted by the FBI's bullying tactics and intimidation that is well known in those communities and has undermined its ability to ever develop relationships of trust.
So let me actually follow that, Commissioner Novick, because maybe get you both to sort of come at the big question that's in my mind here from a slightly higher altitude. We've gotten into some important questions of law and policy. Let me try to state it this way. Dave, you in particular have really done an incisive job of critiquing the FBI's approach and their practices and the AG's guidelines. I followed that, and again, I appreciated the presentations very much. And therefore, the potential danger of associating Portland police officers with those policies and practices and guidelines. So setting aside the question of whether Portland police officers' values could even influence an organization the size of the FBI. There are, after all, only two of them. Let's set that aside. Some people might think they could. Some people might think they can't. If you can set all that aside, there's still a danger. I would think we would all submit that there's some danger. Well, maybe not everyone will admit that. I believe there's a danger. There's some things that keep me awake as police commissioner and as mayor, and one of them is that something like what happened in Paris or Boston could happen here.
Sure.
And so do you see no legally defensible operational advantage? I want to ask you the same question, Casey. Do you see no legally defensible, under our laws here in Oregon and here in Portland, do you see no legally defensible operational advantage to the Portland Police Bureau in keeping us safe in cooperating with the FBI at all or under this arrangement? Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes perfect sense, Mr. Mayor, and I sympathize with your sleepless nights, believe me. I believe that since, and let me say, I'm not a lawyer. I have talked about these issues with national ACLU attorneys who are experts in these matters, and they have assured me that the material I've given you today is accurate as far as they know, to the extent anyone could know it, that is outside of the federal government. But I think, you know, again, going back to the 50,000-foot level, the fundamental question is what you believe will make this community as safe as it can be. Do you want to align yourself with an agency that has been treating everyone as a suspect, including millions of law-abiding Americans, that is amassing huge amounts of data on all of us, that was not able to prevent the Boston attack, and do you think those are the tactics that are going to make this country as safe as it can be? Or do you believe there should be someone out there that adopts a different strategy and tries to increase the amount of safety we might have? Up to now, Portland has been that jurisdiction that has said, no, there is a better way. We want our community to continue to be safe, and we're going to do it consistent with the Constitution and the laws of Oregon. I regret that Portland is alone in taking that stand, but I sincerely believe it is the best direction, that this city took the right move in 2005, that it did everything it could in 2011 to have a symbiotic relationship with the FBI, and the FBI has essentially said to the city, that's all well and good, but as far as we're concerned, you're either in or you're out, and you're out. So let's recognize that now and make it crystal clear to the citizens and residents and visitors and those who work in Portland that the city has taken a different path, and it is every bit as committed to this community's safety as the FBI and the Joint Terrorism Task Force, but it is pursuing a different strategy, one that relies on the community, not one that suspects the community.
Thank you. Mr. Mayor, thank you very much. I think it's a very important and valid question. I'm a father of two children. I'm considering myself as an Oregonian. I'm considering myself a proud Portlander. We all want safety. We want to be a safe community, all of us. And the question will be, you know, are we able to prevent potentially what happened in Paris or what happened in Boston? I don't know. That's a hard question. I think the question we have to ask ourselves is what David said. It's the different strategy. What strategy should we take as a city, as a community? One is that we work with the FBI and assume hope the best, even if the legally we're okay and we're covered. What is that going to do to us, our most vulnerable population who are being targeted into the FBI investigation? And if the strategy is, if that alignment will create exclusion, create members of our community, or law-abiding Oregonians, who believe that they have been targeted and they are fearful of their safety and they are being part of the members of this community. If that collaboration creates that strategy, creates that fear in that community, particular community, I think we should think about it. I think the other strategy is that, do we opt out and say, no, we're not going to collaborate and work with our law enforcement? There is nothing prevents the FBI to pick up the phone and call you or call the our police chief if there is an issue needs to be discussed and solved. They can do that without a JTTF memorandum of understanding if there is an issue. Law enforcement will always collaborate. But for me, the question, fundamental question, is the strategy. So the strategy that we are pursuing is important to members of the community that I work with. That is, we as a city will ensure that we are inclusive for all. And that is the type of security and safety that we are all seeking for us as members of this community. And for us, that's the strategy that I would like for us to pursue, instead of assuming that by sheer luck, if we collaborate with the FBI, even if the legal we might be preventing a potentially unknown terrorist attack. I think for me that's a wrong strategy and that's wrong thinking. I think what we need to do is what David outlined, what we've been outlined from the beginning since 9/11 happened, is that fear does not create, does not prevent terrorism. We are fighting the hearts of the minds of our youth, particularly the work, the youth that the Somali community that I work with. The fight that we are fighting is they're winning their hearts and their minds. And for us, the way to win their hearts and minds, it's not targeting them and making them label every one of them to be a suspect. The way we can win their hearts and minds is creating an opportunity for them to feel they are part of the fabric of our community. That is the type of inclusiveness that I really want us to strive. So for that reason, I think that's a better strategy.
Thank you. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Please.
Mr. Jama, you heard U.S. Attorney Marshall and Mr. Williams talk about the importance to them of the outreach they've done and wanting to develop good relationships with the community. You said that there's a lot of people who see the outreach itself as a form of spying. Is there anything that the FBI could do to develop a good relationship, particularly with the Muslim community? Is there something they could do over the course of the next months or years that could win people's trust?
I am a firm believer that we can work together as a community. I practice conflict resolution. So I think the answer is that yes. There is I think the first of all, number one, is stop spying the community. I think that's the first step that they have to do. Number two, that they have to be genuinely wanting to have a better relationship with the community. And I think I have to admit that our U.S. attorney mentioned the case Muhammad case. That case did not help at all in terms of building a better relationship with our community. So for us, we can always start a blank page, and we're open to that. I am open to that. I think many members of the Muslim community want to have a better relationship with not only the FBI, we want to have a better relationship with our local law enforcement agencies. We want to have a better relationship with our elected officials. We are part of this community. We want to be seen as not others. We don't want to be seen as the one who to be protected from others. We want to be protected and have that extended to us part of this community. And so for me, your answer, Commissioner Novick, is yes, but we have to talk about deeply what that means to us.
I think we may have no more questions for you. Thank you,
thank you.
Very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your presentations. So thank you all for your patience. I hope you appreciated this very good discussion. Thank you. So we're going to ask Carla to do one detail we forgot, which is to read the ordinance that accompanies the second resolution, because we have to read it before we take testimony on it.
Item 148, enter into a memorandum of understanding to become a member of the local Joint Terrorism Task Force in conjunction with the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Thank you. Now, I know we have a number of people signed up. We'd like to extend to some courtesies, because I know there are some parents of young children here in the room, and there's also probably some parents of young children who need to get home and put them to bed. So if there's some folks that have childcare needs that would like to come first, we want to extend that courtesy, and then to anyone who's disabled as well. So if you have special needs, come on forward now before we start the general roll call off the sign-up sheet, and we'll show you those courtesies. So.
My name is Joe Walsh. I represent Individuals for Justice. I wish I could say something brilliant to you right now that would change your mind if you're leaning to rejoining the JTTF. But I can't. The ACLU has just given you a great presentation. There is almost no way that I could build on that. However, there's a couple of things that I learned today just reading. I didn't know that the JTTF was also working with ICE. I didn't know that. I may be the only activist in the room that doesn't know that. But Boston was brought up. They brag that they handled 1,300 cases between the JTTF and ICE. Now, this community has come out very strongly for immigrants. And I don't know if you know that, but if you did, okay, but I didn't know it. So I was kind of taken back by that one. I don't like ICE. I don't like the FBI because you can't trust them because they work in secret. Our police department here, as much as we battle and fight and argue, there is an openness to it. We know, Chief O'Day. We know Chief Reese. We knew Chief Sizemore. We knew the personalities. FBI, shh, it's a secret. We all laugh when I said that, but it's true. It is a secret. Think about this. Senator Feinstein, one of the most powerful women in the Senate, one of the richest women in the Senate, could not speak about the intelligence community, even though she had a secret clearance. She could not open her mouth because it violates federal law. She would go to prison. It's not a rule, it's a law. If you violate confidentiality or you violate classified information, you're going to jail. And what we're asking our officers to do is to think out the FBI. What's the chances of that? That's the only input we get from the officers thinking out the FBI people that they're working with every day. Never going to happen. So that's why we're in the dark. Shh. It's a secret. Thank you.
Thank you. So anyone else that would like to come up early, please come on up.
Be shy. Her name is Shy.
It's okay. Don't have to be shy. And you just have to give us your name. You don't have to give us your address or anything.
My name is Shantina Leith, and this is my daughter, Shy India Alexander, and she's going to read something for us tonight. She's okay. A very good reader. She's a little shy.
Okay, go right ahead.
She has a big voice, and she's a big girl. Come on.
Be shy. We'd love
read
to hear you.
From the top to the bottom. Come on. Read from the top to the bottom. Come on, read.
Following the Civil War, Congress submitted to the states three amendments as part of its Reconstruction program to guarantee equal civil and legal rights to black citizens. The major provision of the 14th Amendment was to grant citizenship to all persons born or naturalized in the United States, thereby granting citizenship to former slaves. Another equally important provision was the statement that nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due to process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws, the right to due process of law, and equal protection of the law now applied to both the federal and state governments on June 16, 1866, the House Joint Resolution proposing the 14th Amendment to the Constitution was submitted to the states on July 28, 1868. The 14th Amendment was declared and a certificate of the Secretary of State ratified by the necessary 28 of the 37 states and became part of the supreme law of the land. Congressman John A. Bingham of Ohio, the primary author of the first section of the 14th Amendment, intended that the amendment also nationalized the Federal Bill of Rights by making it binding upon the states. Senator Jacob Howard of Michigan introducing the amendment specifically stated that the privileges and immunities clause would extend to the states. The personal rights guaranteed and secured by the first eight amendments, historians disagree on how widely Bingham and Howard's views were shared at the time in the Congress or across the country in general. No one in Congress explicitly contradicted their view of the amendment, but only a few members said anything at all about its meaning for this issue. For many years, the Supreme Court ruled that the amendment did not extend the Bill of Rights of the states to the states. Not only did the 14th Amendment fail to extend the Bill of Rights to states, it also failed to protect the rights of black citizens. One legacy of Reconstruction was the determined struggle of black and white citizens to make the promise of the 14th Amendment as reality. Citizens petition and initiated court cases. Congress enacted legislation, and the executive branch attempted to enforce measures that would guard all citizen rights. While these citizens did not succeed in empowering the 14th Amendment during the Reconstruction, they effectively articulated arguments and offered dissenting opinions that would be the basis for change in the 20th century.
Hmm. Thank you. Thanks very much.
So what she read was just the 14th Amendment of our rights.
Yep, very important. Thank you.
That involves slaves.
Thank you for reminding us of that history. Thank you.
Thanks. You going to say something?
I'd like to speak as well.
Go ahead.
What's your name?
Tell us your name.
Janice Walker.
Thanks for coming tonight, Janice. Anything you want to add?
Spit it out.
I don't like police officers because they treat black people like we are criminals. They ride around our neighborhoods and ask us questions and makes us feel unsafe.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming. Appreciate you being here. That's right. It's okay to clap for kids. Thank you very much. Okay, let's move to the sign-up sheet then, please.
Okay, we have about 28 people left. And the first three are Jamie Partridge, Michael Mayo, and Gene Yamamoto. And they'll be followed by Reverend Dr. Leroy Haynes, Brandon Mayfield, and Malcolm Chaddock.
Okay, Mr. Partridge, welcome.
Hi, thank you. Commissioners, Mr. Mayor. I'm here representing the Portland Jobs with Justice, which is a coalition of 95 organizations, unions, community groups, faith-based organizations. Portland Jobs with Justice thinks that the city should not participate in the Joint Terrorism Task Force at all. We think that the legal regime created by the USA Patriot Act and the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996 is unconstitutional and creates the apparatus for police state, even if it's not yet been fully applied. These laws potentially treat nonviolent organizations that coordinate or mobilize dissent as terrorist conspiracies. They subject nonviolent groups to surveillance on the basis of secret listing by administrative agencies that cannot be appealed. And they define terrorism in unusual, non-common sense ways that could potentially affect legitimate means of social action, for example, strikes, if judged to be, quote, economic coercion with a political motive, unquote, in other forms of and other forms of legitimate and necessary resistance to oppression. If the city chooses to participate, it should continue to do so only on a limited case-by-case basis. Any participation should be subject to strong public reporting requirements. There should be security clearance of the Commissioner of Police, as well as the Chief of Police, so that the Commissioner can exercise proper oversight of the Police Bureau's activities in the JTTF. The Portland Jobs with Justice objects to the fact that both versions of the draft ordinances under consideration contain no publicly accessible reporting requirements. We are concerned that officers participating in the JTTF could become a rogue entity in a similar way to the former Red Squads. FBI practices in JTTFs around the country, including Portland, create serious problems of religious and ethnic racial profiling. Their profiling is often aimed at vulnerable immigrant communities. This tends to deepen the Portland Police Bureau's continuing problems with racial profiling. Portland Jobs with Justice thus urges the city not to spend money and energy on the JTTF participation. Instead, turn those resources to end racial profiling by police and creating robust police accountability and community oversight. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Good evening.
My name is Mayo, spelled M-E-O, and I am addressing you for the first time as the officially designated liaison of the Oregon Pacific Green Party, which has 8,000 members and which typically runs third to the Republicans and Democrats in contested electoral seats where other minor parties participate. In my district, for example, I ran third out of six. We are here tonight to discuss the Green Party's attitude toward the JTTF of Portland's participation. We want to talk about in the Green Party that the FBI was founded as a political police. In the Palmer days of 1919, it was the FBI that was there to lead the charge. The FBI has an entire century of being a secret political police. We can ask Martin Luther King if we want anybody to tell us how the FBI treats political dissenters in the United States. And after the JTTF is founded and acts within the jurisdiction of this city, what do we get? We get a 19-year-old Somali immigrant whose father brought him to the attention of the federal government. We get that guy railroaded into life imprisonment and his family broken into smithereens. That's what we get from the JTTF in this city. Now we have that to look forward to, ladies and gentlemen, or should I say, optimes. I have no intention of going into any great detail here, but I do want to tell you how horrified I am that the Attorney General the U.S. Attorney tells us there is going to be some help from the Muslim community after they are horrified that some father who tried to help his adopted country had his son stolen from him and railroaded into prison for life. That is horrible. And it is on a level with that same speaker addressing this group and telling us that the appeal of ISIL is just kill somebody. In fact, the Green Party of the Pacific Green Party of Oregon does not want you not to join the JTTF because there's some better way to prevent terrorism. The Green Party wants to point out to you and to everybody listening that we are an imperial power and there is opposition to the imperialism of the United States. And that is what we are doing. We are enforcing in a domestic area as well as in a foreign area. We are enforcing by violence our hegemony. Now, in order to stop that, the Green Party asks that we oppose the politics of fear. We do as Mr. Jama spoke. We welcome all the members of our community and trust them to work in a cooperative manner. We point out to those assembled here, there are no terrorist problems in Canada.
Mr. Mayo, thank you. Okay, next, please.
Mayor Hales and commissioners, my name is Jean Yamamoto, and I am a board member of the Portland Japanese American Citizens League, the Portland JACL, which is a chapter of the national organization. We are the oldest, one of the oldest Asian civil rights organizations in the United States, and I am testifying on behalf of the Portland JACL in opposition to Portland joining the JTTF. Over 70 years ago, in the midst of wartime hysteria and racism, men, women, and children of Japanese ancestry, many of whom were American citizens, were subjected to curfews, searches, restrictions, and finally incarceration in the name of national security. Our chapter president, Kirk Tambara, was not able to come this evening, but he would like to share his story. His grandfather, Asakichi Tambara, immigrated from Japan to work on the railroads. Leading up to World War II, he owned a restaurant called Nikko and other businesses in Portland's Japantown and was very involved with the Buddhist church. The day after Pearl Harbor was bombed, he was arrested by the FBI. Never having committed a crime, he was taken from his family and community for the entirety of the war and was sent to a detention camp in Santa Fe, New Mexico. A few months later, the rest of the family was sent to the Portland stockyards and then to Minidoka, where they were incarcerated until the end of the war. After the war ended, the family came back to Portland. They had lost their businesses and had to start all over again, as did many other Japanese Americans. And each year, the Portland JACL hosts a Day of Remembrance around February 19th, the date Executive Order 9066 was signed in 1942, authorizing the forced removal of all Japanese from the West Coast. We remember this to honor those who suffered grievously, but also to bear witness to a terrible time when a vulnerable community's constitutional rights were trampled and very few were there to speak up for them. We are at a crossroads today where fear of terrorism is creating hysteria and justifying the sacrifice of some of our civil liberties, especially if it affects the others. 70 years ago, people who looked like me and the Tambara families were the others. Portland is better than this and must be held accountable to all our residents. The Portland police are here to protect and serve and not engage in secret surveillance and other tactics that are against our values. It took 40 years of advocacy by the Japanese American community before the U.S. Congress and the President acknowledged and apologized for the unlawful violations of the civil rights of Japanese Americans during World War II. Let's not repeat the sad, regrettable history. We ask that the Portland City Council vote to keep Portland out of the JTTF. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, please.
Next three are Reverend Dr. Leroy Haynes, Brandon Mayfield, and Malcolm Chaddock, and they'll be followed by Debbie Iona, Dan Handelman, and Joanne Hardesty.
I recognize you. Dr. Haynes, I believe you're on first.
Yes. Thank you, sir. I'm the Reverend Dr. Leroy Haynes, Jr., Chairperson of the Obama Ministry Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform. To the esteemed Mayor Hills and distinguished members of the City Council, as Chairperson of the Obama Ministry Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform, came today concerned about the direction of the city in contemplating rejoining the Joint Terrorist Task Force. As a civil rights advocate for several decades, I've seen with my own eyes and experienced the abuse of power and authority by federal law enforcement, in particular the FBI, and other state and local entities, when it comes to stopping the civil rights movement and the post-civil rights movement, as well as the peace movement in our nation. Indisputable evidence has been presented by congressional investigations, as well as documents from the Freedom Information Act. Whether it was from the FBI bugging of the Dr. Martin Luther King and civil rights workers and character assassination, domestic counterinsurgency by J. Edgar Hoover against citizens exercising their constitutional rights and civil liberties, or the systematic attack on the groups like the Black Panther Party through their COINTELPRO program of the FBI. Our government does not have a good track record when it comes to balancing security and constitutional rights. Let us heed the warnings of our eminent senator from Oregon, Ron Wyden, to not be driven by fear as a nation, to not so easily give up our constitutional rights and civil liberties for the promise of absolute security, but to find a proper and appropriate balance that will not degrade the American Constitution nor our state constitution. If the option of your vote today does not include accountability, I would say, and AMA say, vote against joining the Joint Terrorist Task Force.
Thank you very much. Good evening.
Good evening. I want to thank the former and current council members and the former mayors and mayor for their courage to withdraw and consider participating in the JTTF on what I'll call a trial basis with attempts at full transparency and safeguards. Since I first came to Portland, I first started practicing in Lincoln County. When I first came here after the events of September 11, 2001, I can attest that the local FBI have been routinely questioning Muslims at home and at work, intimidating them to answer questions without counsel, have threatened to put Oregon Muslims on the no-fly list, have put them on the no-fly list if they didn't become informants, as Mr. Fedinke had said, have facilitated torture overseas of at least one Portland Muslim who's a former client of mine and a current client of mine, luring at-risk youth into sting operations when such youth had no preconceived predisposition toward violence, allowed splashy headlines of said sting operations, then immediately and strategically asking to reconsider Portland rejoining the JTTF, keeping illegally obtained information called derivative materials, and then distributing said information to other agencies here and around the world, raiding members of the Somali community, as Mr. Casey Jama had pointed out, federal agents have questioned Somali children at school without parents and, again, without counsel. And the U.S. Attorney's Office has been telling you that the FBI would never gather information about one's religion or keep track of such information because it's against the law, wrong, and unconstitutional. And as some of you may remember, I was arrested on May 6, 2004, in connection with the Madrid bombing on the basis of a faulty fingerprint identification, one in which the FBI and U.S. Attorney's Office withheld from Portland Federal Judge Jones that the Spanish police had concluded my fingerprint was not a match as early as April 13, 2004, just a couple weeks before I was arrested. Every justification for that arrest, besides the fingerprint, had to do with me being Muslim or associating with Muslims or representing Muslims. So put quite simply, I was arrested, surveilled for being Muslim and associations with Muslims, and the FBI, U.S. Attorney's Office, Portland JTTF, procured information about Muslims that they otherwise legally could not have. And it's important, there's something I want to share with you, to keep in mind that I was arrested on May 6th. On May 5th, 2004, the day before I was arrested, an email was sent by Beth Ann Steele, spokesperson for the Portland FBI, admitting that they did not have probable cause that I had committed a crime and that they would arrest me as a material witness if I was outed by the media. There's something else I want to share with you that I haven't had an opportunity to share with you before. It comes from a formerly classified document that was released to me long after the government and the Portland JTTF's blunder in my case. It's an entry from a physical surveillance log detailing surveillance conducted on March 21st, 2004. And on that log, it shows that at 1:03 p.m., the special agent in front of my house reports me leaving my maroon Chevrolet and documents me going to a gas station, going to a Big Five sporting goods store, placing an item in my trunk, then removing said suspicious items at my house with my co-conspirator, who was my son Shane. So what was the suspicious and potentially dangerous item being removed from my trunk? A basketball and a basketball hoop. That's not the important part. The important part is that the same special agent who is at my house reports me departing from my house at 3:19 p.m. And at 3:40 p.m., the task force agent, we're talking about JTTF, task force agent reports subject me standing in front of the Bilal Mosque, which is in Beaverton. The FBI admitted that they had no evidence I had committed a crime, and yet the FBI and task force proceeded to collect information about my religious activities and associations. Portland task force members were violating Oregon law, which prohibits such activity, which I think addresses some of the questions you were asking for. Is there an instance? Here's an instance.
I want you to wrap up soon. I mean, this is really important information, but we're running way over time. So
to sum up, to remain in the JTTF will arguably always be unconstitutional since it's currently used primarily by federal agents to target Muslims and Muslim associations, and when that is no longer fashionable or profitable, they will use it to target the next unsuspecting Japanese, African American, Communist, Green Party, Cop Watch, anti-war protest group, or some other anti-American labeled Association. And for that reason, I respectfully ask that you consider not being a part of the JTTF, and we can still remain safe and strong. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Good evening.
Good evening. My name's Malcolm Chaddick. I'm a member of Veterans for Peace and Individuals for Justice in Don't Shoot Portland. And 13 years ago, before I moved to Portland, I was a member of Peace Fresno. Peace Fresno was infiltrated by the Joint Terrorism Task Force of Fresno County, utilizing the services of one of the sheriff's deputies there. And the only way we found out that was happening at all was because he got in a car wreck and died. And they identified him as who he really was instead of the name that we all had known him by for 6 months. 13 years ago, this October, will be the first time that I walked into these chambers. I'd been in Portland for about 48 hours, and I was testifying to this very issue. 13 years later, we're still at the same place we were back then, which was everybody telling you guys that you can't trust these people, and 13 years later, we're here to finally close that out and say, this is it, okay? That's what I'm hopefully here for, is to watch this end, this process, to finally go to a close. Now, today I sent you all an email that kind of mixed in with an article. I hope the color differences made it comprehensible. But in the article, there was an FBI senior agent who was talking about the fact that they have to ratchet up the fear in order to keep the budget flowing. Okay? That's your culture that you're dealing with. That's the culture you're dealing with. You're not dealing with people who want to keep us safe. You're dealing with people who want to keep their budgets flowing. I got off the phone just a little while ago with two of my old friends from Peace Fresno. After all that went down, the AG of California issued another letter that said, hey, you guys really got to follow the rules. But nobody much got in any trouble except for the sheriff who had detailed that guy. He got in some other scandal in between Peace Fresno's inappropriate surveillance and some other shenanigans he was up to, his career ended. The only thing the JTTF ever brought Fresno that I'm aware of was liability. And I think that what they would bring Portland and have brought Portland in the past has just been liability.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
The next three are Debbie Iona, Dan Handelman, and Joanne Hardesty. And they'll be followed by David Hess, Jason Kofori, and Tom Nelson.
Good evening. Go ahead, Dan.
Oh, I'm going to let Debbie go first.
Okay, Debbie first? Okay.
It's 2 minutes.
Good evening. Try to do it in 2 minutes.
Oh, God.
I know you can speak fast.
Nobody else has those. So.
Oh, right. Okay, thank you, because I don't think I can think that fast and downsize it by a minute and 2 seconds. Okay, so I'm Debbie Iona, representing the League of Women Voters of Portland. Over its 95-year history, the League has developed a set of fundamental principles upon which we act. Two of those principles directly relate to the city's relationship to the JTTF. The League promotes an open governmental system that is representative, accountable, and responsive, and that protects individual liberties established by the Constitution. Furthermore, it promotes political responsibility through informed and active participation in government. The League cannot support rejoining the JTTF. If the city assigns its officers to the task force, Portland residents will have no guarantee that the protections offered us by Oregon law will be honored. As an organization that promotes political involvement, we value prohibitions on the collection and unlimited retention of files on those engaging in political and other First Amendment activities. Without local oversight of our police officers, it is impossible to know if we are benefiting from those protections. The FBI is not responsible for ensuring our officers comply with state law, and asking our officers to monitor their own behavior is impractical and lacks accountability.
By deputizing our police as federal agents, the city will give up the right to scrutinize their day-to-day activities and record-keeping practices. This lack of oversight only invites potential abuse. Furthermore, our officers would be placed in an untenable position. They would be expected to follow Oregon law, yet must work side by side with agents governed by less stringent rules. The League also advocates for governmental transparency. If council should decide to adopt the proposal for a more limited role in the JTTF or rejoin, we recommend rigorous oversight and regular public reporting. This should include periodic review of all critical incident and intelligence-related files by the city attorney and the IPR director for cases in which local officers participate. These reviews should be summarized in written reports presented to city council and available to the public. The League believes that our democracy is strengthened and sustained by active participation in government, that participation can take many forms, from casting a ballot to delivering testimony or joining in a peaceful demonstration. Involvement of that nature is threatened when individuals feel they have to look over their shoulder because they fear they are targets of government surveillance and file keeping. Again, we do not support rejoining the JTTF, and any involvement of our officers with the task force should be carefully reviewed and reported to the public. Thank you.
Thank you. Dan, go ahead.
Good evening, Mayor and Commissioners. I'm Dan Handelman with Portland Cop Watch. At last year's reading of the week annual report, Commissioners Fish, Novick, and Fritz indicated they would back the mayor for pulling out of the Joint Terrorism Task Force if he were not given security clearance. Now it seems the council may be okay with the mayor merely receiving briefings from the FBI. The issue with the JTTF has always been that our mayor is a police commissioner, and it's his responsibility to be sure our officers are conducting themselves consistent with the U.S. Constitution, Oregon law, and local policies. If he cannot review the daily work of these officers, we can't hold them accountable. Having more insight is not the same as having more oversight. Resolution 1 calls to repeal the existing resolution, but retains the requirement for the chief to have security clearance and allows participation when there's specific knowledge of an immediate threat. This is really the same as the case-by-case basis established in the old resolution. The mayor continues to have at least 2 briefings a year from the FBI. The resolution doesn't call to remove the officers' security clearance who are already available to work with the FBI, but it does remove the annual reporting requirement. Resolution 2 calls for Portland to assign 2 full-time officers to be part of the JTTF. The mayor will get quarterly or more frequent debriefs from the FBI, and again, there's no reporting requirement. It's a mistake to assume that the FBI's terrorism task forces are designed to make the community safer, when the FBI has created as many or more fake terrorism scenarios than the suspects they are tracking and often entrapping. Their investigations lead to mistrust in the community, so that even if people have been willing to come forward with information about suspicious activity, now they likely are afraid of the consequences. You've already heard this before, but the prime example is Muhammad Muhammad's father calling the FBI for his help, and his 20-something son ending up being set up and convicted for a fake plot created and funded by the FBI, and he's now facing 30 years in prison. Portland needs to keep being the leader on this issue. When Portland Cop Watch first brought the JTTF to Council's attention in 2000, then Commissioner Hales remarked that Task Force's mission sounded like something out of the Nixon era. The next year, also as you heard before, under Mark Croker, the most militaristic chief we've seen, the Portland Police refused to participate in broad interrogations of our Arab and Muslim communities. In 2005, Mayor Potter, former police chief, took the Portland out of the JTTF because he could not supervise the officers without security clearance. That situation has not changed, despite the proposed contract stating, as Mr. Fidanke read, appropriate supervisory personnel responsible for the police officers must apply for and receive top secret security clearance. There seems to be a trend going on at City Hall. When there's a controversy, don't raise the bridge, lower the river. When we have too few affordable housing units and South Waterfront, the solution is to lower the goal rather than increase the number of units. When the annual reports in the Terrorism Task Force are inadequate, don't demand more information, just get rid of the reports. We've always said that if there's a real threat to public safety that's not manufactured by the FBI, the police obviously should work with the FBI to investigate and prevent harm, but there's no real mechanism to ensure that's the only situation that will work together. Unless there's fundamental reform on the federal level, including an end to restrictions on saying, for instance, how many times they've opened up investigations, there's no way Portland can be an active part of the JTTF. And from the point of view of our parent group, Peace and Justice Works, if the U.S. were to end its foreign policy that generates militant violence against the U.S. and its allies, we would not even be having this conversation.
Thank you. Joanne, welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mayor, City Council members. For the record, I'm Joanne Hardesty, and I'm here today in my role as president of the NAACP Portland chapter to oppose further involvement with the Joint Terrorism Task Force. As you may know, the mission of the NAACP is to ensure the political, educational, social,